the president is not a white supremacist. I'm not sure how many times we have to say that. And to simply ask the question every time something like this happens overseas, or even domestically, to say, oh my goodness, it must somehow be the president's fault, speaks to a politicization of everything that I think is undermining sort of the institutions that we have in the country today. Let's take what happened in New Zealand yesterday for what it is, a terrible, evil, tragic act, and figure out why those things are becoming more prevalent in the world. Is it Donald Trump? Absolutely not. Is there something else happening in our culture where people think, you know what, I think today I'm going to go on TV and live stream me murdering other people?
Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney on Fox News Sunday. President Trump condemned the New Zealand mosque attack, but did not condemn the white supremacy motives of the gunman. And when asked if white nationalism is a growing threat, Trump said this.
I don't really. I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. I guess if you look at what happened in New Zealand, perhaps that's a case. I don't know enough about it yet.
President Trump tweeted a lot this weekend, 29 tweets and retweets just yesterday. And he talked about everything from Saturday Night Live to General Motors to the Mueller investigation. He did not talk about New Zealand. To discuss the connection between Trump and white supremacists, we have A.C. Thompson. He's a reporter at ProPublica, and he's been covering white supremacists. Hi.
Hey. Hello.
Okay, let's talk about this. The gunman in New Zealand. What did he have to say about Trump in that long manifesto?
So the alleged shooter directly speaks about Donald Trump in his manifesto, and he says, quote, as a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose, I support Trump. As a policymaker, no. Dear God, no. Hmm. And, you know, I think that sort of view is very common amongst white nationalists and white supremacists in the U.S. as well. They say, oh, Donald Trump did a lot to catalyze our movement. He's a guy that we see as a symbol who's saying the things that we want to say that we think are important. But as a leader, we think he's something of a failure and something of a policy disaster.
And why do they think that?
You know, there's several reasons. One thing, they've seen the Trump Justice Department prosecute at least a handful of white supremacists who are active at Charlottesville and at other violent rallies. And so they're upset about that. And Trump hasn't done the things that they wanted him to do, like build the wall on the southern border and really crack down on immigration and immigration from Muslim majority countries the way they would like. He's done some of that, but not enough for them.
What about the Muslim travel ban?
That is, you know, for them, they'll say this is like a step in the right direction, but not enough. You know, they want to get to the point where you're seeing people expelled from this country en masse who are not white.
So they like what he says, but not necessarily his actions. He does want the wall, though, and it's not for lack of trying on his part.
Yeah. I think their sort of feeling is he's not a particularly astute political operator. And if he was a better politician, the wall would be built by now. And we would see even more deportations, even more expulsions of people from the country.
So what about what he says? What is it about what he says or doesn't say that they like?
You know, this is a thing that I've heard many times from young white supremacists who have joined the movement in the last few years. They'll say, I have these sort of feelings about race, about nativism, about Islam, and I was afraid to say them, but they were kind of percolating in my mind. And then Trump came along and he basically said the things I was thinking. And that made me realize, oh, you know, there's more people like me out there. I felt empowered and emboldened to express myself more freely. And I wound up joining one of these white supremacist groups.
And let's talk about some of the other attacks. There was the one in Quebec City in January of 2017, where the shooter was an ardent Trump supporter. There was also the synagogue shooting. And then there was this guy, Cesar Sayoc, who had a van covered with MAGA stuff, who had wanted to target various left-wing people, media people. So all of those incidents, those are, I don't know, can they be laid at Trump's feet, or is that just taking it a little too far?
you know, it's hard to make any direct link between any of these incidents and the rhetoric of the president. I think sociologists will tell you that there's something called scripted violence, and that when you have leaders and people in influential positions who start to lay out a worldview that opposes certain groups, that denigrates certain groups, that dehumanizes certain groups, you may well have violence that stems from that sort of sense of tacit approval or overt approval from that leader. And so that's a concept called scripted violence. You know, saying that, we can't directly connect these things to Trump's rhetoric and say, you know, Trump made this speech on this day and this person committed a terrorist act and cited that line of that speech. We can't do that. But I think definitely this moment is the Trump moment is a moment where we see a resurgence of white supremacist activism and terrorism. And I don't think they're disconnected. I think that the Trump moment is helping to embolden, empower this sort of activism and this sort of terrorism on a broad scale.
Mm. He did tweet today, and I'll quote it, "The fake news media is working overtime to blame me for the horrible attack in New Zealand. They will have to work very hard to prove that one. So ridiculous!" Exclamation point.
Right. And I think that's another thing for the white supremacist movement that gives them a sense that Trump is their guy. After Charlottesville, he was very sympathetic to the white supremacist movement. You had a terror attack in Charlottesville where a neo-Nazi drove a car into a crowd of counter-protesters. And while the president condemned that, he also said, hey, there were very fine people on both sides of the conflict that day. And for people like David Duke and other white supremacists, that was a sign, hey, the president's on our side. Now, when you see him failing to really recognize the white supremacist component of the attacks there and the fact that ideology was the driving force behind what happened, and that the shooter apparently has a sense that Trump is on his side, at least in some way, the fact that Trump is not acknowledging that, again, will be a sign to the white supremacist and the white nationalist that he's their guy.
AC Thompson reports for ProPublica and Frontline. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Whether President Trump's rhetoric is partly to blame for the rise of white supremacy around the world or not, it turns out that white supremacy has deep roots in Australia and New Zealand, going back for centuries. Here to tell us more is David Atkinson, Associate Professor of History at Purdue University. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so tell us how white supremacist ideas got their start in Australia and in New Zealand.
Well, it's, of course, a complicated, long story, but I think it's imported, really, with British imperialism at the turn of the 18th century. You know, British settlers are bringing these ideas with them. And I think what's important at the outset is the idea of white supremacy is about how superior to other races the white British settlers are. This is an idea that's brought to both Australia and New Zealand by British settlers. But by the time they get to this faraway place that's so distant from Europe and so distant from other white people, it takes on a different form. It becomes a much more fearful and anxious idea. And rather than kind of celebrating the racial superiority of whites, it becomes about protecting that fragile racial superiority from other non-white races that white New Zealanders and Australians feel surrounded by and threatened by, I think.
But isn't that just the story of colonialism around the world in general? I mean, here in the United States, of course, with Native Americans and in Africa and in Asia. That has been the story, right, when white people go to colonize?
It absolutely is. It's a commonplace story. I mean, you see exactly the same thing in Canada, as you say, in the United States. What I think is really different about Australia and New Zealand is the distance is such, and the proximity they perceive to other non-white races really exacerbates the intensity of it. And so the very kind of existential meaning of what it means to be white in New Zealand and Australia is intensified by that distance from other white people and proximity to other non-white people.
And then there were actual official policies set up called White Australia and White New Zealand. Tell us about those.
Yeah, these are immigration policies, essentially, that are put in place first in New Zealand in 1899 and then in Australia in 1901. And in both cases, their reactions to Asian immigration, or I should say rather the fear of Asian immigration, because very few Asian immigrants actually have come to either place. And so what they want to do is put in place immigration policies that prevent non-white immigrants from coming to New Zealand and Australia. But the problem they face is that both of these places are British colonies at the time, of course. And Britain has a large multi-ethnic empire that is full of non-white subjects. And at the same time, the British are negotiating a treaty with the Japanese, who are one of the biggest targets of these ideas. So the British government says to Australians and New Zealanders, look, you can't explicitly, racially deny these people access to British colonies. It's too offensive. It'll cause too many problems for the empire and our foreign relations with Japan. So you need to come up with a new way to do that. You need to come up with a disguise, essentially. And so that's what both New Zealand and Australia do in 1899 and 1901. They come up with immigration policies that essentially impose literacy tests, education tests, on all incoming immigrants.
Well, and that sounds familiar.
It's a test that is drawn from, actually, tests that were applied against African-American voters in the American South. It was the same idea.
And I'm just wondering how that plays out today. What is the attitude towards immigration and diversity in New Zealand and Australia today?
It's still a deeply contentious issue. These are far more multicultural communities than they ever were, certainly before the 1970s when these laws finally end. But there's still a great deal of anxiety, whether it's about Asian immigration or refugee immigration from Syria and Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka and places like that. These are not resolved debates.
And the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, he is a hardliner on immigration, right?
He certainly is. And in fact, I think he just issued a statement saying that this should not affect the fact that Australians are in the process of further reducing the number of immigrants they accept into their country. There's a real debate going on and has been for decades in Australia about the appropriate number of immigrants that should be allowed to enter the country.
By immigrants, is he talking about legal immigrants, or is he talking about undocumented immigrants, or is he talking about refugees?
Yeah, there are essentially three different conversations. There's a goal to actually limit and restrict legal immigration. I think the latest number he talked about yesterday or today was 14,000 people a year. And that doesn't include then the refugee issue that's constantly being fought over in Australia.
Is there a big inflow of refugees to Australia?
There certainly has been in recent years. It's dwindled greatly. What the Australians started to do in the past 20 years was offshore, as they called it, their refugee asylum seekers. So they'd place them in Papua New Guinea or the island of Nauru, and they created essentially refugee camps in these places to basically process these people. And that's been a really difficult debate that Australians have been having for over 20 years now.
And how has that debate differed in New Zealand?
It's been, you know, most of these people are trying to reach Australia. So this has always been the historic situation in the South Pacific. Most people are coming to Australia first. And so New Zealanders don't face the same kinds of pressures. Australia is seen as a bigger, more open, more mobile, more lucrative society. And so people tend to travel there first. So New Zealanders don't tend to have to deal with these problems until the Australians have, if you understand.
Mm. Any indication that this shooter, the mosque shooter, drew specifically inspiration from the history that you just talked about?
You know, it's strange because I think what's really animating white supremacist individuals like this guy in Australia is on a different kind of axis than what we were talking about 100 years ago. So now, you know, there's this sense of a broader white civilization. It's not just British anymore. It's not just American anymore. But there's this notion that white people are being subject to essentially a racial genocide because of the immigration of Muslim immigrants and refugees, asylum seekers, et cetera. And so it's less about that kind of old idea about Anglo-Saxonism and more now about this notion that whiteness itself, some kind of imagined global whiteness, is under threat. So he'll reach out much more to arguments that are going on in Hungary and Bulgaria than he seemed to be interested in these older discourses about white supremacy.
Well, thank you for a fascinating conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
David Atkinson, he teaches history at Purdue University. Coming up, does Paul Manafort face double jeopardy if he's tried in New York State? The Legal Eagle weighs in next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Double jeopardy. That's when you're charged for the same crime twice. It is illegal under our Constitution. There are some questions that Paul Manafort may be a victim of it. He's been sentenced to more than 7 years on federal charges, and now he faces charges in New York State. Are they the same or similar enough to fall under double jeopardy? Let us ask our legal eagle. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, is here as she is most Mondays. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. So Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan DA, wants to charge Paul Manafort with a bunch of crimes. What does he want to charge him with?
So he wants to charge him with 16 different counts, and they essentially involve things like mortgage fraud, falsifying business records, schemes to defraud in general. And the question, as you laid out, is essentially, are these the same offenses for which Paul Manafort has already been convicted in federal court? So there's actually a number of different double jeopardy clauses floating around this question. First, as you mentioned, the U.S. Constitution has a double jeopardy clause. It's in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. And actually, part of that clause is subject to a new Supreme Court case that was just argued on December 6th. So we might have different law in June about what exactly the federal double jeopardy clause means. But generally speaking, it means you charge someone for a robbery on January 1st in district court in Virginia. You can't charge them again for the same thing in a different court. So you can't charge people twice. You can't punish them twice. Mm-hmm. But I don't actually think that's the double jeopardy clause that's at issue here. It's the New York double jeopardy clauses, which are both in the New York Constitution and New York statutory law. And New York, kind of fortunately for Paul Manafort, has one of the nation's most stringent double jeopardy rules.
So it goes far beyond what the Constitution says?
It does, because why not make this as complicated as possible? And so what Cyrus Vance is doing is basically saying, we know you might get a pardon. We want to make sure that you, Paul Manafort, serve some jail time. And so I'm charging you with these new offenses. About 11 to 12 of the 16 new offenses do look like they substantially overlap with the federal crimes that Paul Manafort has already been convicted of and sentenced for. So the big question
is... So his lawyers are going to argue to throw those out.
Absolutely. So his lawyers will say, hey, New York, see above, see your constitution, see your statute.
Well, Vance must know the Constitution.
He does. And he said, no, we can work around it. And he said that this doesn't fall within the double jeopardy clause. There are exceptions to that clause. New York has this kind of bizarre double jeopardy clause where there's two different provisions. And the first is basically you can't charge someone twice for the same offense. We get that. But then there's this other clause that says, and you can't charge people twice if the facts that give rise to the crimes and the elements are substantially the same. And then there's eight different exceptions to that rule. So that's what
so
Paul Manafort
could be in court for a long time just debating over whether or not this constitutes double jeopardy. Forget about the actual crimes or alleged crimes themselves.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
short answer,
TBD,
yes.
TBD is the short answer. But let's be clear that Vance said this, even though he's aware of the double jeopardy, you know, jeopardy, shall we say. He did say that he is doing this expressly so that Trump won't pardon Manafort and he'll get away with serving no jail time.
Absolutely, because there's a lot of discussions about, well, what if the president pardons and then fill in the blank Paul Manafort and, you know, any number of other people kind of caught up in the Mueller investigation.
Safe to say Michael Cohen off that list.
Yes.
Anyway.
For now. But the president only has power to pardon over federal offenses.
Right.
The president has no power to pardon for state crimes. That would be the purview of a governor. And so this is why you've seen, for instance, after Paul Manafort's trial, and the jury hung on some of the legal questions, people said, actually, maybe this isn't good news for Paul Manafort, because now a different state attorney general, and for those crimes, maybe in California or Illinois, can now charge him with those crimes because he hasn't been convicted of them.
Okay, let's talk about gerrymandering, change the subject a little bit. Supreme Court heard one case today. It's hearing two cases next week. Safe to say they're concerned with gerrymandering there at the Supreme Court. What do these cases say?
Well, the case today deals with racial gerrymandering, and we have a standard to determine when state lawmakers draw lines that dilute the power of racial minorities. They typically do that by either packing racial minorities into just a few districts so they have no influence in the other districts, or quote-unquote cracking racial minorities into many districts so they can't get a critical mass mm-hmm. to pick the candidate of their choosing in those districts. Now, the cases next week are really interesting because they deal with partisan gerrymandering, which is when state lawmakers draw district lines in order to try and keep, maintain, and get more political power based on whether or not they're Republican or a Democrat. We don't have a standard in our country to determine when you have created a partisan gerrymander that's illegal. So one of the main things that the court's going to look at next week is, first of all, can federal courts even answer that question about partisan gerrymandering? Do federal courts belong there? Or is that just a political question? Two, what's the standard? And then once they find what a standard is, was that violated in either of those cases? So those are, I think, the biggest cases this term. Listeners might remember I said that last term, too, and the Supreme Court totally punted on the partisan gerrymandering questions.
Would any of these cases have any effect on the next election, the next presidential election?
Well, so the census is coming up very soon. That's actually one of the other big Supreme Court cases in this term, which will be heard in April, dealing with the census and whether or not you can ask citizenship. So to the extent that the Supreme Court gives us a new standard to use for drawing district lines, that would affect the 2022-2024 elections, mm-hmm. but nothing for the 2020 elections.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, millennials and the economy.
It's not that burnout is like something that you catch like the flu and then recover from. It has been my base temperature for probably going on the last 8 to 10 years.
Why millennials can't seem to get a break and they are burned out. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Millennials always seem to be ruining something. The 9-to-5 work week, the diamond industry, dinner dates, cloth napkins. Well, one millennial writer says she and they have not gotten a fair break. They are not lazy. She says, we are burnt out, overworked, and underpaid, and that's why no dinner dates and cloth napkins. Anne Helen Peterson wrote about this for BuzzFeed News, where she's senior culture writer. Hi.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. All right. Well, what is a millennial? Can you just give us a broad definition?
So the technical definition is anyone born between the years of 1981 and 1986. And I think, you know, like any generation, it's very fudgy on either side. Like you can, you know, just because you're born in 1980 doesn't mean that you aren't feeling many of the same things as a millennial.
Yeah. Well, you describe a culture of burnout that you feel personally. What does that look like for you?
Well, I think for a long time, and this is kind of the premise of the article, is I did not recognize this overarching feeling that I was experiencing as burnout, because I thought burnout was something that, you know, you went on vacation, you went to the beach, mm-hmm. you turned off your phone for a day, and then, well, I'm not burnt out anymore, right? So when someone would say, maybe you're burnt out, like my editor said that to me and I said, no, like I'm still working. And as I,
which
how
is
can
the
I
problem,
be burnt out
right?
if I'm still showing up,
yeah.
right? And as I read more about burnout, really in an attempt to try to figure out some of my more annoying behaviors, like inability to get things done on my to-do list, it dawned on me that, oh, I'm thinking about it entirely the wrong way. Like, it's not that burnout is like something that you catch like the flu and then recover from. It has been my base temperature for probably going on the last 8 to 10 years.
Well, you write early on that you would avoid doing these mundane, petty tasks. Seemingly high effort, low reward tasks would paralyze you. You just wouldn't do them. Like what? Like picking up your dry cleaning, that kind of thing?
Yeah, like the example that has amused many people is I could not get my knives sharpened. And so it's one of those things.
Well, join the club. My knives are
yeah,
sad,
it's hard.
Dull
well, and you get all this conflicting advice like, don't buy a knife sharpener, you'll hurt your knives. Like, there's just, you know, it's one of those things where there are too many options, too many inputs, and then you find yourself paralyzed. Which has actually a lot to do with the way that we experience burnout is that, you know, if there's a straightforward way to do something, like, I don't know, doing your own laundry, if you have a washing machine in your house, that is easy.
Yeah.
It's more of these more complex things like, I need to make a doctor's appointment, but I'm new in town. I don't have anyone to ask about which practice I should go to. Then I have to call them. So it's those kind of tasks that really end up on that bottom half mm-hmm. of the to-do list.
Well, I guess I'm wondering what's wrong with that, because we all have to prune. And it's good to prune the stuff that doesn't require your immediate attention.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the tips that I have read in response to my article about dealing with burnout is to separate in your life urgency from, you know, important. And I think oftentimes our lists become this, everything is urgent.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are some things that I do want to do and that actually, you know, part of the reason they don't get done is because they do benefit me. And taking care of myself is often the last thing on my to-do list. So whether that's, you know, getting a mole check, mm-hmm. like that's a very mundane thing, but it's an important thing for my health, or emailing back someone from like high school who wrote me a really nice email, you know, those sorts of things, those are important. And I think if we're always ruthlessly prioritizing, I mean, if anything, I have been ruthlessly prioritizing for the last 8 to 10 years. And what that's done is put work at the top. Always.
So that's the deeper issue that you get at later in the essay, that because so many millennials, yourself included, are working this freelance life and they don't have the security of benefits or of a full-time job and they have huge college loans to pay back, they do have to constantly work. And therefore, these other things get pushed aside. Important things like getting your health checked or connecting with a friend, that gets pushed to the side because you're just always working.
Yeah, and I would say, too, that it's not even limited to people who are working, you know, the three side hustles to try to make one good job. You know, I actually do have a full-time job and have benefits and that sort of thing. But in order to keep up with the pace of my job and to prove myself on the job, I have internalized this idea that, you know, any time that I am working is good, and any time that I'm not working, even if it's paid time off, even if it's, you know, specifically like you should take a weekend or whatever, there's something inside of me that says, like, you could be working now, this is bad.
But how is that not just you're young and hungry and type A, and how is this instead a generational problem?
Well, I think that, first of all, I'm pretty old. I'm old for a millennial.
Well, don't say that to me.
I am the oldest of millennials, so I am 37. So it's not just like I am out there, like, you know, striving to get that first secure job. I think that the job precarity and just the general precarity in terms of, like, steady work jobs that have any sort of long-term security, you know, what some people might think of as careers, that has been something that has been elusive for our generation. You know, most of us entered the job force during the economic downturn. For me, I actually went through two. Like, I graduated undergrad into the dot-com bubble burst and then went back to school and then graduated from grad school during the aftermath of the second financial crisis. And so for most of us, like, it has always been hustling or going back to school and then trying to figure out, so I have this advanced degree and I should be finding jobs. You know, why am I not finding them? You know, I had a PhD and couldn't find work.
Right. And we are in at almost full employment. The unemployment rate is so low. So you'd think that you would have your choice of jobs. And that is, in fact, the cliche when people talk about millennials in the workplace. They just seem to up and leave whenever they feel like it.
Well, I think one thing that I often see left out of the conversation about almost full employment is what kind of jobs we're talking about, right? So if you have a job freelancing or a part-time job or a job at a retail organization that switches your schedule every week, making it pretty impossible for you to arrange childcare, that's a job, right? Like, you are considered part of this full employment statistic. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a job that's allowing you to both cover your student loan and save for a down payment and put aside money for in case of a catastrophe.
Does your argument cut across race and class?
So the way that I think about it is that a lot of people across race and class have responded and said, yes, this is like the outlines of what I'm feeling, but let me also tell you about how burnout accumulates differently for me as a first-generation immigrant, as a Black woman, as a disabled person. And so I think one of the most valuable things about the response to the piece is that I started a conversation, or at least gave language for us to start a conversation, and that now we are having more in-depth and more specific conversations that hopefully decenter my own white middle-classness. You know, so much of the conversation about millennials has long been centered on this white middle-classness, and I don't want to perpetuate that any further.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is the answer then? Millennials band together and do what?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing, right? Is that millennials just now, we are really moving into places where we are managers, where we are starting or taking control of companies, where we are being elected to office. And I do think that if we are mindful, right, that we can hopefully change that relationship to labor. And it takes being conscious not only of trying to cure your own burnout, but also what am I doing in my life that is exacerbating other people's burnout. For me, the simple act of turning off my phone and putting it into airplane mode before I go to bed, so that instead of, you know, reading the latest news about the presidency and politics and scrolling manically through my phone, I am just reading books. And I can't tell you, it's like a very simple idea, but it has had profound change just in the last month.
Well, I will say that before you put the phone down, you should read your newsletter, because it's really great.
Thank you.
It's called The Collected AHP, and it's free. So sign up for that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was great talking with you.
It was so great talking with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. That's Anne Helen Peterson, senior culture writer for BuzzFeed News, where you can read her article, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, and subscribe to her newsletter. Coming up, the woman who invented the paper coffee filter. Yep, her name was Melita. As one of many women who changed the food world, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There is an old and outdated adage that a woman's place is in the kitchen. That is, unless you're talking about professional kitchens, of course, then the top spots tend to be dominated by men. And they really rack up the top professional honors and get credit for pushing cuisine forward. Women have played a pivotal, if less well-known, role in shaping the way we eat, though. Let's think of the coffee filter, the donut, mass-produced champagne, modern Mexican food, all developed by women. Food writers Deepi Aluwalia and Steph Ferrari wanted to help give women a little more recognition for their kitchen accomplishments, and so they co-wrote a book called A Woman's Place, The Inventors, Rum Runners, Lawbreakers, Scientists, and Single Moms Who Changed the World with Food. And Deepi and Steph join us now. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Well, so women have been cooking for millennia, of course. how did
Indeed.
You go about picking the women that you wanted to include in your book?
It was challenging, honestly, because
we could have written volumes. I think when we first sat down to research, the big question was, can we find enough information on these women to really put a book together? Because, of course, typically, throughout history, regardless of industry, men were the ones recording things. We knew that women were there, but we didn't know if we could find enough information to put a full book together. And honestly, we wound up with so many wonderful stories that it was challenging to cull it down.
Mm. So some women ended up on the cutting room floor, so to speak.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. There are more stories to tell.
Okay, well, let's talk about a few of them. One of them I thought I had no idea was behind the coffee filter. Her name is actually Melita Benz, right?
Yes.
And so that ubiquitous green and red package with the filters in it, that was her invention?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that was such a fun find for us. Because, as you mentioned, that box, that green box, I think we've all seen it at the grocery store. Uh-huh. And we've probably all purchased it at one time or another. But she, with basically a handful of change, started this company. She was born in Germany, in Dresden, Melita. And she was fed up with the way that coffee filters of the time were ineffective. They were cloth. They were hard to clean. And one day she grabbed a sheet of notebook paper out of her son's notebook. He was doing some homework, and she poked some holes in it and made a filter out of it, and just saw the opportunity there to create a business, which is still very much, this iconic brand now. So I loved that story. Just this, I think a lot of these stories we found women were just sort of fed up with one thing or another and decided to fix it.
And this was in the early 20th century?
Yes, exactly.
Tell us about Josephine Cochrane, the inventor of the dishwasher.
Well, this is Deepy. Josephine hated the dishes, man. They were dirty and they were piling up, and the help kept chipping all of her good china. And so she decided to pick up a wrench and fix it. And she showcased the dishwasher at the Chicago World Fair, and it became a hit. And it started off in restaurants at first. It was massive, mm-hmm. not exactly the whirlpools that we have in our kitchens today, but it definitely set the groundwork to all the companies and paved the way for all the companies to come after her. And I believe the company became Whirlpool.
KitchenAid.
It was, again, another groundbreaking invention.
Right, and this happened in the late 19th century?
Yes. Yeah. And she was, she was obsessed with it. She just sort of, after her husband died especially, she had been tinkering with this idea. And once he passed, it became not only, something about cleaning the dishes, but it became about survival. And what's, I think, fun about a story like that is if you follow the line, of the impact, what did that do for women in the home? And that freed up a lot of their time, mm-hmm. And it allowed them to maybe experiment or do different things, and it became part of the era of, women's lib in a lot of ways. If you follow it all the way to the 1950s, when women were able to kind of use these appliances and things like that, because that's around the time that the dishwasher became available, more available to the homeowner.
So, this is a very political what you're talking about, right? The dishwasher mm-hmm. and the other inventions that free up women to actually do more than just tedious housework.
Right.
And so you have this chapter called Instigators, and the subhead is these ladies weaponize the food we eat for social change. How do they mm-hmm. weaponize the food we eat for social change?
I think, this section in particular was really interesting because we had to have a lot of conversation about, again, to your point, to your question originally, what made it into the book. Did these women have to be chefs? Did they have to be women that were actually creating, a dish or something like that? And we just came across so many interesting ways that women used food to their advantage or food business. There were just so many that we felt that it warranted a whole section here.
Yeah, just to jump in, Women of Protest was an amazing section just to get into how women use food to create that social change. From the March on Versailles, and you have, Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette are literally having a ball and feasting on cake and all this wonderful food. And where the people in Paris are like suffering and not having enough bread or food on the table. And these women united, 7,000 plus women united, wielding pitchforks and walking all the way down to Versailles and basically dragged him out of there. And it sparked and helped kind of push forward the entire French Revolution. Then go to India. We have the Salt March. This is, you know, the taxation on salt and a commodity that we all use when we cook. And here the British colonial government was forcing the Indian population to basically buy this salt and taxed it heavily. And then Gandhi, we always associate with being, which rightfully so, led this peaceful protest. But Kamala Devi was a huge supporter, but she rallied the women to do a separate march to Chaupati Beach. And they set up chulas, which are makeshift stoves on the beach, and they cooked their own salt. Hmm. And they took it a step further. And now they're selling that salt in the capital, and they're organizing another march. And she's getting, you know, she's burned, and she's not leaving the protest behind because she's invigorating more women to join in. So you just see this over and over again in history. And like Steph was saying earlier, there's many women that we left out. But I feel like every culture has a story where women have come together, and is usually linked to food to create kind of the social change.
Yeah, and then literally financing, in the case of Georgia Gilmore, using her food to help finance the Montgomery bus boycott.
Definitely, definitely. And that was, if you think about how long that bus boycott actually went, it was like 380 some odd days.
Yeah.
So for over a year to fund that is no small feat. And, you know, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, again, rightfully so, they were huge in that movement. But Georgia Gilmore, inspired by everything that she's seeing and hearing, wanted to do something. And all she had was her two hands and a stove. And she put together the dishes she knew, you know, chicken sandwiches, there were sweet potato pies, and started selling those at these meetings. And then she got more women involved. And the cool thing was they created, I mean, these are all working women. They know the repercussions of doing something like this. They know they can get fired. They'll be evicted. So they created this group called the Club From Nowhere, so that if someone was to ask them, well, where are you getting this money from? They could say, well, it's coming from nowhere, and not have to lie about it. Mm. So it was really interesting how just this keeping this boycott going, selling this food, providing, you know, gas money for other modes of transportation, they were able to prolong this enough for the Supreme Court to rule that this was wrong, that the segregation of the bus system was absolutely, you know, wrong. It was immoral. And so the entire thing was because of the efforts of women like Georgia Gilmore.
It's so interesting that you looking at the way you are looking at food and women cooking, as soon as the food is taken out of the kitchen, it becomes subversive and mm-hmm. dangerous mm-hmm. and political. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting take on.
Yeah, I think, you food. Know, to return to sort of that idea of weaponizing food, I mean, this was the available tool that they had. It was the thing that they, you know, it was thrust upon them to be the providers, the people that fed, you know, their husbands or, but that was what they had. So they learned how to use it for their efforts as well.
Let's talk about Encarnacion Pinedo, because here in Los Angeles, we would definitely see and taste her influence. Tell us about who she was and what she did.
She was a feisty woman, to say the least. But she, you know, coming from a Mexican family who was very well off, but given the American-Mexican War, her family kind of fell into this financial stress, and she was angry. She was cooking. She was bringing Mexican flavors into California, into this American cuisine. But she started writing this book, and there's recipes in that that are kind of, in a way, sticking it to the white man. Like she thinks the food is, you know, Englishman's food is boring and bland. Here are exciting spices and ingredients that she's bringing into the landscape. But it was kind of this forgotten little cookbook. It wasn't until later on when Ruth Reichel, when she was the Los Angeles Times critic, when she came across it and recognized the importance. Like this literally would have made, you know, Alice Waters and the whole California cuisine founders extremely proud. This was before its time, cooking with fresh ingredients, bringing the local flavors into play. And the actual publication of the book was then printed in English. And I believe the title is Encarnacion's Kitchen.
Yes.
And that became like this extremely important volume for Mexican Americans who can now look back and say, look, our heritage goes way back. We're not just taco trucks. We're not just a, you know, the burrito joint down the street. Mm-hmm. We go all the way back to the time before, you know, California was just now being founded and discovered.
So this book is called El Cocinero Español. Can you still get that book? Is it available?
It was republished in 2003, I think, on the University of California Press. And now I believe it's called Encarnacion's Kitchen.
Kitchen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you can find the text.
And so where do you take it now? So women, there are tons of women chefs in professional kitchens, lots of restaurants run by women. Obviously not as many as men, but, you know, women have come into their own when it comes to pushing cuisine forward into new and interesting ways.
Yeah, I think that was such an inspiration for us when we were coming up with the concept for the book. These women have done amazing things. They've really paved the way. They've opened a lot of doors for women to be able to step into the kitchen, but to run a kitchen, to open their own restaurants, to be the food writers and the media that shapes so much of what we eat and think about today when it comes to food.
And more to that point is also about where is this going to go now? So there's a future generation, there's young girls who are going to come across this book. I have two small daughters, and the elder one is almost 7, and she's seen this entire process over the last year of culling through all these women and me telling her little tidbits, and she's fired up. And this is kind of the whole thing when we started brainstorming this idea, was maybe it'll inspire the younger generation to say, you know what, so-and-so invented this, I can do the same thing. Or someone picked up this ingredient and said, wow, I can make potatoes into, you know, vodka. Not saying a child should make vodka. But
why not?
Why not? But the whole idea is just to be inspired. Like, you know, get that passion ignited, and so that they can carry it. And who knows? Who knows what the next invention is going to be, or the next culinary trend is going to be, or where these women will go above and beyond the kitchen. So, I mean, that was always our driving force behind this, is like give the credit where it's needed, and show women of today where their foundation came from, but definitely drive it forward for the ones who are coming up behind them.
Deepi Ahluwalia, Steph Ferrari co-wrote the book A Woman's Place, The Inventors, Rum Runners, Lawbreakers, Scientists, and Single Moms Who Changed the World with Food. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for us here at Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.